This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Pelka. Protesters set up makeshift barricades across the streets of Yangon against Myanmar's soldiers one day after the military killed more than 100 people. Sunday, several demonstrators, mostly young people, wore helmets reading Save Myanmar and held arrows and petrol bombs. Petrol bombs, or Molotov cocktails, are common at barricades that have sprung up in many cities and are regularly pulled down by police. So far, their main use seems to be to create flame and smoke to confuse security forces trying to open fire on civilians. Soldiers opened fire from a distance, but no casualties were reported. More than 100 people were killed Saturday as security forces cracked down on protests against the February 1st coup that ousted Aung San Suu Kyi's elected government. The reported fatalities included several children under 16 years old. Suicide bombers attacked a Catholic church on Indonesia's Sulawesi Island on Palm Sunday, wounding at least 19 people. A video obtained by the Associated Press showed body parts scattered near a burning motorbike at the gates of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Cathedral in Makassar, the capital of South Sulawesi Province. A priest at the church said he had just finished celebrating Mass when the explosion happened. He said security guards at the church were suspicious of two people on a motorcycle who wanted to enter the building, and when they went to confront them, one of them detonated explosives. The wounded included four guards and several churchgoers. We have more international headlines for you on voanews.com. This is VOA News. There is continued hope Sunday that salvage efforts would free a mammoth container ship blocking the Suez Canal the last 6 days. The trapped ship has cut off international trade through the canal, causing losses worth millions of dollars. The Marine Traffic and Vessel Finder application said two tugboats were on their way to the vital waterway to help the salvage operation. Experts pinned hope on a high tide to dislodge the vessel. The MV Ever Given, which is longer than four football fields, has been wedged diagonally across the span of the canal since Tuesday, blocking the waterway in both directions. The crisis has forced companies to reconsider rerouting vessels around Africa's Cape of Good Hope, a longer and more expensive way to travel between Asia and Europe. Billions of dollars of cargo are now stalled at either end of the Suez Canal, and each passing day results in millions of dollars in losses for Egypt and commercial enterprises around the world. Bangladesh security forces opened fire and used tear gas Sunday to disperse thousands of protesters who were enforcing a nationwide general strike. They were protesting to denounce violence at a previous protest over a visit by India's prime minister. The area's police superintendent said at least one man was shot in Sonarpara after thousands of protesters, mostly students from Islamic schools, blocked a major highway connecting Dhaka and the southeastern port city of Chattogram. Witnesses said scores of people were hurt in clashes with police, which started after protesters set fire to a number of vehicles. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's Facebook page has been frozen, according to a spokesman for the social media giant. That's because Facebook says the page contained misinformation about the COVID-19 pandemic. A statement from the company says Maduro violated Facebook policy when he posted a video without any medical evidence promoting carvativir as a cure for the coronavirus. Carvativir is a drink made with the thyme herb, which the page described as a miracle medication capable of neutralizing the coronavirus without any side effects. The company said it is taking action to limit use of Maduro's Facebook page, freezing it for 30 days. Saturday, the United States condemned China's sanctions against two American religious rights officials and a Canadian lawmaker in a dispute over Beijing's treatment of Uyghur Muslims and other minorities. China's moves only contribute to the growing international scrutiny over the ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
And we want to believe that the demonstration, if people are supposed to be taking this political party seriously, is by adopting as many young people as possible into positions as members of parliament to contest in the August election.
A civil society group calls on citizens to reject lawmakers who have served more than 20 years in the Zambian parliament.
We don't want to leave any sector untouched. We want to make sure that the length and breadth of this country, every remote area, that will show our faces, communicate with the people, and to make sure that the message is well extended to them in a language they will also understand.
The Electoral Commission of the Gambia meets with political parties in preparation for the December presidential election.
With the new variant of the COVID-19, the government had to take measures because the procedures of law is very cumbersome. If the spread continues at the magnitude in which it is, it might also affect the prison guards.
And Cameroon issues orders to speed the trials of prisoners following inmates' protest about the spread of COVID in detention centers. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In France, President Emmanuel Macron has received a report detailing the country's role in Rwanda's 1994 genocide. The study was carried out by a commission established by the president to investigate the country's policies before, during, and after the mass killings. It followed years of accusation that Paris failed to do enough to either prevent or stop the genocide. The report says France bears overwhelming responsibility for Rwanda's genocide, a charge denied by French authorities. The 1994 mass killings left at least 800,000 minority Tutsi and moderate Hutus dead in 100 days of bloodshed. The massacres began after the shooting down of the plane carrying then-President Juvenal Habyarimana. For reaction to the report's findings, I reached VOA's Silvanos Karemera in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
The government statement, which came out one day ago, applauded the French report by French experts, and specifically in this communique, the government highlighted that this was a good move, a good step forward towards putting to light exactly the role of French government back then, 27 years ago, in the genocide committed against the Tutsi here in Rwanda. So basically, and in a brief nutshell, this report by the government of Rwanda was really praising or applauding what has been contained in this report by the French experts.
Kalamera, what has been the overall mood in Rwanda?
I think some of those people that I've managed to speak to applauded this report. I have not read the full report. I've simply read the preamble and abstract of the report, just like those people that I've spoken with on the report. But most of those people that I have spoken with have received this report with much happiness, saying that the current French government of Emmanuel Macron has in recent years demonstrated a goodwill towards the normalization of the relationship between the French government and the current government in Kigali. So most of those who have spoken to me, at least, have really appreciated what is contained in this report, because they believe that now that, to some extent, the French government or French authorities are admitting that they failed gravely in the genocide. So to them, they think it's been high time now, but they believe that now there's a smoke at the end of the tunnel, that finally maybe French will be admitting what they think is the undoubted role in the genocide 27 years ago here in Rwanda.
Kalamera, I also understand the government will soon come up or release its report about an investigation it conducted about the role countries played in the genocide in Rwanda. What can you tell me about the anticipation in Rwanda about the government report that will soon come out in the next few weeks?
I'm not quite sure what exactly is coming up in the very report that I've just mentioned, but to some extent what I'm sure of is that now that the relationship between France and Rwanda has really been good terms for the last couple of years, I don't think what will be coming up in this particular report by the Rwandan government is going to be perhaps contradicting what has been released in this French report. So I think both governments or both experts from both countries are putting in mind that the two countries have really gone further in normalizing their relationship compared to the previous years. So I think, much as I don't understand exactly what will be coming up, but I believe maybe something good is going to be happening going by this report, which is coming up maybe in the next 2 or 3 weeks, so to speak.
Looking forward, with this report that President Macron has received, with the statement the government has issued out in Rwanda, how do you see the relationship moving forward between the two countries?
Let's say this. Now that the French experts have released the report, which has been received very well here in Rwanda, and going by the normalization, the good relationship that has been existing between the current French government with Rwanda, I think if you put them together, to my understanding and my opinion, I think the relationship between the two countries, which has been soured by the accusations from either side, I think the next few years, the few years to come will be better, actually, if you compare it to the previous years between the diplomats of the two countries.
That was VOA Silvanos Karamera. He spoke with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. In Zambia, the Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI, a civil society group, is calling on citizens to reject lawmakers who have served more than 20 years in parliament. Andrew Intewewe, head of the group, is calling on political parties to replace older veteran politicians with young candidates in the upcoming August 12 general election. His remarks come after parliamentarian Givin Lubinda, who is also Zambia's justice minister, announced he will not run for re-election to parliament. Mr. Lubinda, who is one of the country's longest-serving lawmakers, says he'll rather focus on his business. This, he says, will allow others to contest the vacant parliamentary seat. Andrew Intewewe tells me that if the country is to move forward, voters need to elect a new generation of leaders with fresh ideas.
What we are calling on now is for political parties to be able to adopt as many young people as possible to participate as members of parliament. Now, we have noted also that in the event that political parties are stubborn and they adopt veteran politicians who have been in parliament for more than 20 years, our call is that the Zambian people must be able to reject those leaders. And the reason why we are saying this is simple. Young people possess new energies, skills, and will rejuvenate parliament. We also rejuvenate the way we are governing ourselves as a country.
But Andrew, some people are saying that if that is the trajectory of what you are asking for, then basically you are advocating for age discrimination and experience to be trashed for young blood. How do you respond to that?
So we are not talking about age discrimination here. First of all, you want to be able to understand what we are talking about is for those members of parliament who have been in parliament for a very long time. This matter has a genesis. And the genesis comes from the decision by the Minister of Justice, who has decided that after serving 20 years, he is ready to step aside. And all we are saying is that there are so many other members of parliament who have been in parliament for more than 20 years. We are calling on them to say, can you please step aside? What we are simply saying is that there is need for continued rejuvenation in terms of the governance of the country. There is need for constantly coming up with new ideas and new skill sets and new leaders who are able to bring something new on the table.
Given Lubinda's decision, it's a personal one. Zambians, as you know, also say that they want experience in leadership coupled with the young, as you are advocating. So why are you forcing those with experience to be pushed aside for only young blood to take the helm of leadership? What happens to the combination of the two?
Our view is that the older generation can play a very important role in this country. And we believe that they have so much experience. We believe they have wisdom, which the younger generation can tap from. But it's a question of where they are going to be able to give, what mechanism they are going to be able to use to give this wisdom, this knowledge to young people. For instance, one of the key things we have suggested to Honorable Winda is that he should set up an institute for young leaders. We want to believe that other members of parliament who have overstayed, who have been over in parliament for over 20 years, can also contribute by giving wisdom, knowledge to upcoming parliamentarians. This is what we believe. What we believe is that there must be entry mechanisms in politics, in leadership. There must also be exit mechanisms. One of the biggest problems in Africa today is that we don't have effective exit mechanisms from leadership. That's why you discover that people reach 80 years, they still want to be presidents. That's why you discover that people who want to be in parliament for over 25 years, and they still want to continue, because they have taken being in parliament as a vocation, as employment, rather than as a service. And this is what the Young African Leaders Initiative is saying no to.
Andrew, so within the Zambian context, how feasible is this call? And how soon do you think these political parties will embrace your call?
This is what we have been doing for the past 10 years. What we have been doing for the past 10 years is to advocate for a brand new leadership. That's what we have been doing. And we want to believe that political parties, if they are supposed to be taken seriously by the Zambian people, they will adopt as many young people as possible to contest as members of parliament. You want to understand that Zambia is a very youthful population. Over 70% of Zambia's population is composed of young people below the age of 35. And these are young people that must take a leading role in terms of the direction that this country is supposed to be able to take. And so we want to believe that political parties, for them to even be attractive to the general citizenry, they must be able to attract new individuals coming on board. And the way we are looking at this matter, we are looking at it across a political divide, both from the governing party point of view, as well as from the opposition political parties. They have been telling young Zambians that they are going to allow young people to effectively participate in the governance of this country. And we want to believe that the demonstration, if people are supposed to be taking this political party seriously, is by adopting as many young people as possible into positions as members of parliament to contest in the August election.
Andrew Interwewe heads the Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI, a civil society group. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In the Gambia, the country's Electoral Commission has initiated a series of meetings with political parties in preparation for the December 4 presidential election. Officials say the talks, called the Inter-Party Committee Meeting, or IPC, will address concerns of all stakeholders before the poll. This as the commission begin preparations to organize the December presidential poll. Dudu Jah is the executive secretary and deputy secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC. He tells me that electoral officials likely want to tackle any problems that could undermine the vote.
We have regular meetings all the time, especially when the issues arise in regards to politics or election matters. At the moment, things are going on smooth. We're working towards the 2021 December elections, that's December 4th. We had some concerns in the past that when the voter registration process was postponed till further notice, which has now been scheduled from the 29th May this year, running to 11th July. At the moment, things are going on fine.
What about the sensitization of the people of the Gambia in readiness for the elections? Are the political parties talking about coordinating with the Electoral Commission to ensure people are well educated in readiness for the elections?
Yes, Mr. Peter, that's also happening. There are two committees that have been formed. There's a steering committee responsible for election matters, where you have the embassies All the diplomats, they meet with the IEC as stakeholders to see how to support the IEC in order to facilitate that. We also have a technical committee in place, of which the IPC is represented. We have civil society, we have the media, that is Gambia Press Union, and other stakeholders, UNDP, ONEP, IRI, they're all on board. The National Youth Council, how we can all play our quota, Women's Bureau. They're also part of the monthly meetings that we conduct in order to engage. Each and every one of us has a domain, an area, or a sector where they can handle in disseminating information and to motivate people to come out and register and vote, like women, youth, elderly, political parties, all of us together. We just had a meeting from the technical committee a few days ago, which I, myself, and another colleague represented the IPC.
Has all the issues that you raised at the IPC meeting properly addressed to prevent any instances of sharp disagreement that could taint the upcoming elections?
It's a bit, if not all, most of them have been addressed. The issue of ballot paper, I think the majority of political parties, we have said the time is very prompt. We can shift that for other elections or the next presidential election. And the IEC have heeded to that after when they explore all angles and, you know, accepted the fact that it is really prompt. And as far as sensitization is concerned, we're working very hard on that. Spreading peace messages, we're also working on that. I think the key issues have been taken care of, and at the moment we're working in uniformity with the IEC and other stakeholders in order to ensure that we'll have a free, fair and peaceful election. And finance too, it's coming, and more is expected from stakeholders that they are going to support.
Dudu, how about the cooperation with other stakeholders, including civil society groups, as part of an effort to ensure a transparent electoral process?
Yes, civil society are also playing a crucial role, as election is everybody's business. They are not left behind. Like I said, in the technical committee, they are fully represented. Gambia Press Union are there, ONEP Gambia is there. And you have all other bodies. It's like a coalition of CSOs that have been represented. Even the judiciary, the Minister of Justice, the Ministry, the Interior Ministry, all have been brought on board. No sector has been left out at the moment. It's all inclusive how we can all work hand in hand. They have every right to partake and participate in elections, and every room has been created for them. They are also on board. So far, so good. Things are going as it is, and we only hope and pray that it will continue like that.
So what should the people of the Gambia be expecting from all the political parties, the rival political parties that have been meeting under this inter-party committee to try to hash out any possible challenges before the elections? What should be their expectations?
The expectations will be positive. As far as the Gambia is concerned, the IPC is one of the most valuable institutions that Gambians look up to that can unify this country. As far as politics is concerned, we all have put the interests of the nation first. So this is why we have been engaging them, but we want to intensify that engagement, you know, through sensitizing them. The National Center for Civic Education, they're also playing a crucial role. The National Youth Council is playing a crucial role. We don't want to leave any sector untouched. We want to make sure that the length and breadth of this country, every remote area, that will show our faces, communicate with the people, and to make sure that the message is well extended to them in a language they will also understand.
Dudu Ja is the Executive Secretary and Deputy Secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. Cameroonian
Gambian authorities say they have issued orders to spread the trials of prisoners after inmates protested the rapid spread of COVID-19 in overcrowded detention centers. Prisoners say it is impossible to follow government COVID-19 safety precautions without access to water and face masks. The Yaoundé-based maximum security prison was built for 1,500 inmates, but now holds about 4,500 prisoners, one prisoner says. The overcrowded prison is putting inmates at risk of COVID-19, he says. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Prisoners in Cameroon's overcrowded prisons are protesting what they say is neglect in prison centers, leading to a rapid spread of the coronavirus. Over the past months, protests were reported in several locations, including the Kondigi Maximum Security Prison in the capital, Yaoundé, the New Bell Prison in the coastal city of Douala, and the Central Prison in the English-speaking western town of Bamenda, according to authorities. A Kondigi Maximum Security Prison inmate told VOA that prisoners have been holding prayers for 30 minutes every day for the past 2 weeks. During these protests, prisoners say they have been crying out for help, pleading for protection against the spread of the virus. The prisoner, who asked to remain anonymous for fear of retaliation, was able to speak to a reporter via the messaging platform WhatsApp.
The COVID-19 is ravaging our country. We need to be able to have proper hygiene. At times, to cut water for 2 to 3 days, to wash hands. It's very, very difficult. Government should come and look for solutions so that together we can help to fight this COVID-19 and ensure that we have a proper hygiene.
The prisoner said sanitation in the center is poor and it is overcrowded. About 4,500 inmates are in the facility, he said, built to hold fewer than 1,500 prisoners. Lack of sanitation and face masks add to the difficulties prisoners face where access to health workers is limited. Authorities say the country has about 30,000 inmates in 78 overcrowded detention facilities, built to accommodate maximum of 9,000. The government says close to 700 of the 16,250 inmates tested within the past 3 months in 21 prisons were COVID-19 positive. Fewer than 300 tested COVID-19 positive last year. Justice Minister Laurent Esso said there is a spike in COVID-19 cases among inmates, but he rejects prisoners' claims that inmates get very little assistance, saying the claims are unfounded.
Les décès dont nous parlons ici sont des décès intervenus en cours de transfert à l'hôpital parce que il est arrivé.
He says a few inmates whose health conditions were already critical died while being rushed to hospital. There is lack of awareness among inmates about the virus, and many inmates don't come forward once they test positive, he said. Additionally, following precautions to keep a 1.5-meter distance from one another is difficult due to the overcrowding of these centers. However, inmates are required to wash their hands regularly, and face mask requirements are enforced, he said. The government has reduced the number of visitors and suspended all social gatherings and activities at prison yards to limit COVID-19 spread, Esso says. Esso said all inmates will be tested for COVID-19 and those infected with the virus will get free treatment. He said the government will administer anti-COVID-19 vaccines to prisoners who accept vaccinations. Fabrice Vaveni-Lena is the coordinator of a non-governmental organization, Prison Watch Cameroon, that works to improve the living and health conditions of inmates. Lena says to reduce the spread of COVID-19 among inmates, the government should free pre-trial detainees who have been held for long periods with no evidence of wrongdoing.
The prisons are overcrowded. This is largely due to the number of persons that were taken from the Anglophone crisis, some whose keys have not even been opened at the military tribunal, and some who have already been condemned. With the new variant of the COVID-19, the government had to take measures because the procedures of law is very cumbersome. If the spread continues at the magnitude in which it is, it might also affect the prison guards.
Lena said the government could also grant freedom to people who have served up to half of their prison time sentences for misdemeanors. Esso said he had given instructions to judges to speed the trial of suspects in tribunals all over Cameroon. In April 2020, President Paul Biya announced that thousands of the country's prisoners would be released in an effort to lessen prison crowding and prevent the spread of the virus. Inmates were among the groups with the highest level of exposure, according to the government. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, the UN Refugee Agency says two refugee camps for Eritreans in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region have been destroyed and abandoned. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
UN agencies have been unable to access Tigray since November, when Ethiopia began its military offensive to wrest control of the region from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Aid workers finally were allowed to reach two refugee camps, Shimelba and Hitsat, that had been out of bounds for months. The UNHCR and UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs conducted a joint mission to the area recently and found both camps had been destroyed. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshakov says the camps, which formerly housed some 20,000 Eritrean refugees, were deserted, and all the humanitarian facilities had been looted and vandalized.
In Hitsats, most of the shelters in an area known as Zone A, as well as UNHCR's offices and staff guest house, were burned to the ground. The mission confirmed what satellite imagery and accounts from refugees had indicated at the beginning of this year. UNHCR is deeply concerned for the well-being of the Eritrean refugees who had been residing there, all of whom have fled the camps.
Earlier in the crisis, more than 7,000 of the refugees had fled the camps for security reasons and headed for two other Eritrean refugee camps that were not directly affected by the conflict. Cheshakov says his agency has been in contact with more than 2,000 other refugees who have fled to various parts of the country for safety.
We have around 7,000 to 10,000 Eritrean refugees still dispersed in the region, and also in places where we have not yet had access, but we are working to identify where they are and to provide them with support, working, of course, closely with our partners and with the authorities.
Local authorities have reported the presence of some 95,000 Ethiopians who are internally displaced within Tigray's Shiraro administrative area. Cheshakov says all the refugees, as well as Ethiopian displaced, are in dire need of urgent life-saving assistance, including food, shelter, health care, water, and sanitation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Egypt's Suez Canal Authority is trying to refloat a giant container ship that is blocking traffic in a main artery of the canal and disrupting world trade, which passes through the strategic waterway. Here's Sylvester Kututa, chairman of the Kenya Shipping Agent Association, reacting to the situation at the Suez Canal. His answers include how the jam will affect shipping businesses from East African ports, goods to Europe that are likely to be delayed, as well as alternate routes in case the logjam takes longer.
Yes, it's 1 week since the blockage of the Suez Canal. And of course, there are many effects that has happened to the trade by sea from East Africa. We know that in the old days, there was a lot of imports from Europe, Mediterranean, and the UK to East Africa and Southern Africa through the Suez Canal. But in terms of imports today, we see more of East African and Southern African and indeed African imports coming more from China and from Asia since Asia and China began their industrialization quest some decades ago. So there is little and more little and less a traffic of imports coming from Mediterranean these days and from Europe and from the UK. That's as far as the Suez Canal blockage and imports from the traditional areas which pass through the Suez Canal. And therefore, we don't expect very much, a lot. Yes, indeed, there will be an effect, but not very much as compared to in the old days what would have happened, and especially during the last blockade of the Suez Canal. In those days, traffic used to be more imports from through the Suez Canal. But when we get into looking at the exports, this is where the major issue is. A lot of exports from East Africa, a lot of exports from Southern Africa. Let's say East Africa exporting tea and East Africa exporting coffee, which are our major commodities, including also reefer cargoes like avocados, which we in Kenya are very good at exporting to Europe, French ports mainly. These are going to be very much affected because they are shipped on a weekly basis out into Egypt. And we know that Egypt is a major consumer of Eastern African tea, and also the UK. And when we come to coffee, there's a lot of coffee going into the Mediterranean ports and northwest continent of Europe. So these are definitely affected because this is traffic that passes and goes through the Suez Canal. They are being affected at the moment. And as long as this continues, their supply chains will be very much affected. Either there will be cancellation of orders, or there will be delayed orders, or some will be airlifted, or they will have to use the longer route through South Africa and West Africa to be able to access European markets. Obviously, that comes at a premium and an extra freight rates, which we are coming from the pandemic. We're coming from a slowdown due to pandemic COVID-19. And therefore, any increase in freight rates obviously will have an impact on the global economy. So again, what are the solutions that we see at the moment? I have alluded to a couple of them. Any urgent cargo that cannot wait will have to be airlifted, and that is very expensive. Second solution would be to steam extra days via southern tip of Africa to West Africa for cargo going to Europe. But there's another option as well, where shipping lines can use port facilities to stockpile cargo's full containers, even as they wait for the Suez Canal to be cleared up. And once the Suez Canal is cleared up, then they can load those containers from some kind of a transshipment port or a port of temporary storage. And in this case, I'm thinking of the port of Lamu, which obviously there is a good stacking area. It's ready for use. There is not much, there is no congestion, and there is capacity for putting up several full shiploads of containers. The challenge would be, how do you handle that cargo in a port like Lamu where there is no port facilities? But that can be sorted out in a bit, in a way, because some of the ships, like the Ro-Ro ships, they carry their own equipment and they don't need cranes, they don't need shore cranes. So, for example, the Ro-Ro ships can discharge there in Lamu by using their own equipment because they are self-sustained ships. And then when the Suez Canal clears, then they will bring in the ships.
Sylvester Kututa is the chairman of the Kenyan Shipping Agent Association. He spoke from the capital, Nairobi. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. It was a busy week in African football. The Gambia qualified for their first ever Africa Cup of Nations tournament after beating Angola 1-0 at home, joining Comoros, Gabon, Ghana, Egypt, Zimbabwe and Equatorial Guinea in qualifying on Thursday. The other slot in Group D was secured by Gabon, who beat DR Congo 3-0. Elsewhere, Egypt drew 1-1 in Kenya to secure the point they needed in Group G to qualify for the finals in Cameroon. The Pharaohs now have 9 points, level with the Comoros, while Kenya move up to 4 points and join Togo, who have just 2, in being eliminated. Comoros qualified earlier after a goalless draw at home to Togo. Ghana drew 1-1 with South Africa and made it through from Group C. Zimbabwe won 1-0 away in Botswana. The result, coupled with Zambia's 3-3 draw at home to reigning champions Algeria, means Zimbabwe joined the holders as qualifiers from Group H. Zambia, the 2012 winners, are eliminated. Elsewhere, Equatorial Guinea beat Tanzania 1-0 in Malabo to qualify from Group J. Tunisia, who beat Libya 5-2, had already booked their qualification from Group J. Meanwhile, a 3-0 win over Niger put Ivory Coast through to the finals. Cape Verde shocked already qualified Cameroon by beating them 3-1 in Group F. In Group I, Congo drew 0-0 with Senegal. Congo now need only a point from their last game against Guinea-Bissau to be sure of being in Cameroon in 2022. Morocco drew 0-0 with Mauritania, but went through after Burundi drew 2-2 with the Central African Republic. Guinea-Bissau still have a mathematical chance of qualification after beating Eswatini 3-1 in La Bamba. And Burkina Faso qualified after drawing 0-0 with Uganda on Wednesday. Burkina Faso's 9 points in Group B is one ahead of Uganda and 2 more than Malawi, who beat South Sudan 1-0 on Wednesday. Burkina Faso qualify, as there is no scenario where both Uganda and Malawi can overtake them, while South Sudan, who have 3 points, are eliminated. Malawi host Uganda in the final round later this month, with the winner qualifying. A point will be enough to take Uganda through. Elsewhere, Ethiopia beat Madagascar 4-0 at home and moved closer to qualification from Group K. In Group C, Sudan won 2-0 in Sao Tome. In Group F, Rwanda beat Mozambique 1-0 to move second on 5 points in the group, led by Cameroon with 10 points, while Cape Verde and Mozambique have 4 points apiece. And Nigeria are through to the final, but Group L rivals Benin will have to wait after conceding an injury time goal to the Super Eagles and losing 1-0 in Porto Novo. In the same group, Lesotho drew 0-0 with Sierra Leone. Next January's Nations Cup should have been played in 2021, but was delayed by a year because of the global coronavirus pandemic. 24 teams will be at the tournament. And finally, in boxing, Dillian Whyte kept alive his hopes of a heavyweight world title shot by beating Alexander Povetkin with an impressive knockout win in the fourth round in their rematch. Only Anthony Joshua and Vladimir Klitschko had previously beaten Povetkin in 39 fights. For 41-year-old Povetkin, retirement now looks likely, while Whyte may have a chance at a title shot. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Baby, dance, dance, baby, shake, shake, yeah.
and you can dance it too.
Yeah.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, even the sharpest ear cannot hear an ant singing. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.